You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, October 15th, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Hi, folks.
And we have a special guest this week, George Robb. George, welcome back, man.
Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome. Come on in.
That's my one. Hi, guys.
Hello.
George.
I know what that
Hello.
Is. George, what's up, man?
How are you guys doing?
Good. So Kara is not with us this week because she had something come up last minute. She's actually been very good about keeping her schedule clear, as busy as she is on our recording night. But something very good came up, and she's had to be in an event this week. She will tell you all about it next week when she's back on the show. But that's why she's not here. So, of course, we took the opportunity to bring back our bud, George. So, George, I hate to start on a down note, but
yeah,
we do have to update our listeners.
I know.
On your friend. So tell us what's going on.
I hate to do this. Yeah, it's unfortunately, I know a couple months ago I spoke on the show about the singer from the Philadelphia Funk Authority, Alyssa B. Anderson. She was fighting cancer. I asked people to send emails, and your listeners did, like, unbelievably generously so. I got about 1,000 emails that I put into a book and I gave to Alyssa.
Wow.
Well, yeah, it was so awesome from all over the planet. I mean, all over the planet. And, she was moved, and her mom was moved and touched by it and loved it. And she would show it off to everybody that she could show it to. Regrettably, unfortunately, and extremely sadly, she died last Thursday. She was in hospice for the last, 2-3 weeks of her life, left us. And it's incredibly sad.
It's very sad.
And horrible. Yeah. And
she was young.
She had just turned 50. She had had a 50th birthday party that she had. She looked like she was 25. I mean, you would never know she was 50, but, amazing.
Yeah.
So you guys saw her sing with the band when you guys came down back in January.
Oh, talent. Raw talent.
She was fantastic.
I was wondering, as this was, of course, happening, and as she died on last Thursday, of course, there were tons of comments on Facebook. There were multiple pages that were sort of set up, and some were, everyone's sentiment was beautiful and touching and moving. But I had to cringe, internally, and understandably, but I had to cringe, every time someone would say, she's in heaven now singing. And I understand why someone would say that. And I got into an interesting conversation about, we all in some way delude ourselves and make the pain, we try to lessen the pain somehow.
Yeah.
Some of us say, oh, she had all these friends. She was a great influence. Her recordings will live on. And some say, to deaden the pain on some level, well, she's in a better place, how do you guys feel about that when you sort of see that or when you hear that? Cause I hate having to, that someone would have to create a fantasy, which is so sort of self-placating,
I hate it.
I agree, George. I had a friend I went to high school with die.
Right. You just, you had this horrible, yeah.
Well, no, this was somebody else. Sorry. But
oh,
this was
okay.
Someone from high school. So I kind of stalked his Facebook page for a while afterwards because that was giving me some comfort until it got to the point where he was gone for like about 3 or 4 months and people were talking to him on his Facebook page like he was alive.
Mm.
Oh, hey, happy birthday. I know that you're, like having full on conversations with him and things. And I'm like, this is not healthy. It's weird.
I mean, they did it knowing he was dead?
Yeah, they did it, but it was like, his Facebook turned into like him, and it wasn't, I read the post and I'm like, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
This is all weird now.
Is it denial? Is it like how much of it is denial and how much of it is sort of just sort of the accepted thing to say on some, oh, she's in a better place or he's in a better place or whatever.
Yeah, I think there's
loss of,
but I think it's both of those things, George. I think definitely some people use these kinds of things as a salve, to deaden the pain.
Because
it's horrifically painful when you lose somebody close to you. I mean, how do you deal with it? You got to work through it somehow. So that's why I give people a pass when you, if they're, you know, somebody close to them dies, whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't care what they say. But yeah, it does make me cringe. You know, the skeptic atheist in me down deep cringes whenever anyone says anything stupid like that. When a friend of our family died when we were younger, we were teenagers, and a friend of the family said, "Well, when it's your time to go, it's your time to go." And I got so angry at that. Right. It's like, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. And it was like, it was the, whatever effect she intended it to have had the opposite effect.
Right.
It's like, really? You just think that God's up there and ticks the box. Like, well, today's the day you die. No matter what you do, this is what's going to happen to you. Why?
Do you think it,
pointless.
It diminishes? I mean, does it diminish the loss? And it's like, I've done talks about, you know, this, about grief and about how, like, the pain reminds you of the value.
Yeah.
And if you sort of try to deaden the pain, does it devalue that, or does it just sort of delude you? I mean, if someone posted, "Oh, it's great. She's on a spaceship now, you know, circling Mercury," you would think, okay, that person's not really.
You're insane. Yeah.
You're insane.
Well, they're speaking more to themselves than they are to the person they're trying to remember and kind of pay a little homage.
Now, I think if you share a faith with somebody and you're talking to them in the context of your shared faith, that's all fine. But you got to be, people just assume that they share faith with a broader group.
Right.
And that's, I think,
right.
problematic. I do think that our instinct is to say something to deaden the pain, and that is a bad instinct. I think people don't want to hear it's going to be okay or whatever. It's I have a real loss.
Yeah,
you don't have to try to take it away or diminish it or anything. Just come up with something else to say, which is just like, "I'm here for you," or whatever.
Right.
Something other than, you know, the instinct to make it seem like, "Oh, it's not that bad." No, it is that bad. It's
right.
bad.
Yeah, it's horrible.
It's bad. Horrible. Yeah, yeah. Just to go with it. You shouldn't have to deny that.
Right. There was that, and there was also, of course, you know, all the comments about, you know, "God bless you."
Yeah.
You know, while she was still ill, you know, all of this sort of, you know, which to me, again, it's like, wait, yeah, does, what, like, where does his responsibility start in terms of his, like, wasn't he sort of responsible for the bad stuff too? Or is like, okay, now all of a sudden,
hey, George, what do you mean? Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, come on.
And, you know, I think that those statements are largely selfish because people are saying it not to comfort the other person, but to diminish their own discomfort with the situation, with having to confront the sorrow, the pain, and the loss.
Do you think, are they trying to provide some?
Well, that's the justification for it, and,
right.
and maybe that's part of it as well. But I think that the real motivation, the emotional motivation, I got to say, this is so horrible. I have to give myself an out. You know, I got to say something.
Which I get. I get it. Like, I don't want to disparage individuals, and it's like it's easy to kind of point and go, "Oh, you're weak because you're thinking that," and I don't want to do that necessarily. But it's like, just personally, it just...
Yeah, I know. That's what I say. I give people a pass. It's not like I call them on it in the moment, but yes.
Right,
inside, I'm like,
yeah, it's like, oof.
The other situation I think as skeptics that we confront, and this is difficult, is when somebody's sick or in a difficult situation, and then somebody who genuinely, sincerely means well gives horrible pseudoscientific advice. You know,
sure.
It's like, you should, avail yourself of this woo nonsense because it's going to help you. And then it's like, yeah, I don't want to be mean to somebody who's just trying to be nice, but you're an idiot. You know, that's again, this is my internal dialogue.
Right.
But it's, you know, but you have to sort of gently respond to that, but it puts us in a very awkward position.
Yeah, yeah. Dale, the trombone player and singer, who Dale's a big guy. Dale's like 6'5", giant guy. You know, we finished the song.
Gentle giant.
Yeah, that was the last song of the first set. We both went backstage and we both just lost it. And he gave me this hug and it was like hugging a couch that was standing. And I just wanted to sleep for like a day, you know, and
I was
going to
say,
bawled.
I mean, you know, you don't even really have to say anything.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Just give somebody a hug.
Absolutely.
All right. So we have a good show coming up. We're going to have a interesting conversation a little bit later in the show about science fiction movies. But first, the forgotten superheroes of science.
Yeah, Steve. So for this week in the forgotten superheroes of science segment, I'm going to talk about Alice Evans, who was an American microbiologist. She was the first to connect the fact that there's harmful bacteria in milk that also influences human illness, and she strongly urged for the pasteurization of milk and seemed fairly instrumental in achieving that. So Evans received a BS in bacteriology from Cornell University in 1909, and she worked primarily for the dairy division of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Now, she studied bacteria in cows' udders that are transferred to the milk. And sometimes cows got what's called Bang's disease. It goes by various names. I think it's from the Bacillus abortus microorganism. And but it's also considered – it was not considered harmful to humans, but she kind of suspected that it might cause some problems in people, specifically something that's called undulant fever. And it turns out after her research that she was right. So she reported this in 1918 in the Journal of Infectious Diseases. But the scientists of the day were skeptical. They did not really believe her. And part of that reason, probably a good chunk of that reason, was because she was a woman at that time. Remember, this is in the late, like 1918, 1919. So that clearly had to be a factor. But also, she was not only a woman, she was a woman without a PhD. So, you know, how could she discover something so significant that has eluded so many other people? So even during this time of skepticism, she warned them. She's like, hey, you know, this milk should be pasteurized to protect people from the host of diseases. And it wasn't just undulant fever. And then finally, in the 20s, years later, other scientists made the same findings. And then, of course, they were, you know, much more believable because they were, you know, real scientists and men, of course. So her efforts clearly led to the pasteurization of milk in around 1930. Milk seems kind of innocuous. Hey, it's milk. Oh, but how bad could that be? But that's easy to say in this modern day because in its raw form, which was, of course, everywhere back then, it's really dangerous. It causes three times the hospitalizations of any other disease outbreak caused by food. The CDC seriously considers it one of the world's most dangerous foods because of that. They even said that between 1998 and 2011, 79% of dairy outbreaks were directly related to raw milk or cheese. Which is amazing to think even then. If you look at it, pasteurization can prevent not just that fever, but also diphtheria, scarlet fever, tuberculosis, and more. And it also, pasteurization can kill listeria, E. coli, salmonella, and many more of those as well. So clearly it was a huge, huge boon to something that so many people consume the world over. So remember Catherine Evans. Mention her to your friends. Perhaps when discussing the effect of HTST milk on the micelles of casein protein.
Wow. I always assumed like that pasteurization of milk was like right away with like that Louis Pasteur was doing.
Yeah, I thought that too, but it's not true.
It was.
So what was the first thing pasteurized then?
Beer and wine.
Really?
Of course.
Yeah. Oh, that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense.
That was in 1864. So that was almost.
Wow.
66 years before they applied it to milk. Yeah, I didn't realize it was such a gap there. I thought it was pretty much right as soon as Pasteur just figured out the pasteurization.
Well, they thought, like I said, they thought the milk was, oh, this is safe. It's not a problem. But she's the first one to show that, no, this is clearly a problem. It's causing these issues. We've got to deal with
it. And still today, there is a raw milk movement. You know, people think, oh, you're killing the milk.
It's utter stupidity.
The natural.
Steve, what is the absolute worst thing that can happen to you from drinking raw milk?
Death.
You could die. You could die.
Death.
It's not a significant probability, Jay. I think in the outbreak that they tracked in the late 90s and early 2000s, I think there was only a few that actually died. But you could get some nasty diseases. She actually contracted, I think it was accidentally, this undulant fever that raw milk can cause. She was sick. It affected her health for 20 years. I mean, and think of the things that I mentioned, diphtheria, tuberculosis, Salmonella, E. coli. I mean, that's
Sal. Yeah,
that's
Sal.
A huge Sal. Those are some big benefits.
I'm trying to picture her in the corner of her office. You know, once they start pasteurizing milk in the 30s, 10 years after she suggested it, just the look on her face, like, really, really, guys? Okay, yeah, great, thanks, thank you, great.
It took you so long.
Thank you.
Oh boy, how many people unnecessarily got sick or died because of sexism, just because she wasn't taken seriously enough,
right?
You know, and it delayed the using a procedure that had existed for 66 years. You know, that
there you have it. Sexism kills. Next topic.
All right. Thanks, Bob. All right. Going to do a few news items before we move on. Jay, I understand that astronomers have found the most interesting star in the galaxy.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit of hype here. A little bit. Let's have fun with this, right?
This is
somewhat of a sci-fi themed night, as our listeners will come to see. So I'm going to start by asking a fun question for this news item. Question. If we found an advanced alien race and observed its home star and planet, what would it look like? What would we expect to see in the solar system?
If we were looking at a star that had alien civilization.
Yeah, advanced alien civilizations. You know, we would see probably some
pyramids,
interesting
ships.
Anomalies, right? We'd see some.
You'd see some spaceships.
Like infrared, like an anomalous infrared signature that would mean something like a Dyson swarm or Dyson sphere. Well, I guess a true Dyson sphere couldn't really happen, but something that is using the light the sun as a you know, all the energy from the
harnessing source, the energy yeah. of the power right. of the sun, right?
So that would be big. Or megastructures that clearly would require some sort of solar system scale engineering that is just so far beyond anything we could do. Those are the things I would expect.
When you're saying megastructures, you're not talking about like those giant gummy bears, right?
No.
By definition, anything
like
we could
moon
see,
sized, planet
yeah, anything
size.
We could see would be a megastructure.
All right, yeah, so now consider this news item, and then we'll talk about how blown out of proportion the internet was over the past few days.
What?
So starting in 2009 and lasting 4 years, the Kepler Space Telescope focused on a particular area found in the northern hemisphere sky, looking for slight dips in light from over 150,000 stars all at the same time. So when these dips repeat over time, right, we pick it up as a pattern. It's a great indicator that there's a planet moving in front of the star. This is how we do it. With that much data being collected, the Kepler science team didn't have the computer power, the muscle to push through all of it and run their algorithms. So they came up with not such a novel idea, but a very good idea that they would recruit people to do it. And they ended up calling this team of people the Planet Hunters. Now, this was a program that was started by the Kepler scientists to find what they call citizen scientists to look for and find light patterns. By looking at the imagery. Like, you know, when a planet moves in front of its star and we're looking at it through one of our telescopes, we'll see that the star actually dim just a little bit because the planet is, you know, blocking some of the photons that were just hitting our eye, say, a few days ago or whatever.
Is this like crowdsourced? Is that crowdsourced?
Yeah.
Like Galaxy
yeah.
Zoo? That, like that
exactly.
kind of thing?
Yeah,
oh, wow.
yeah.
How
it's
cool.
not just
awesome.
Not just distributed computing. It's actually getting people's to look at the
to
the
look
patterns.
And analyze.
Yeah, and just a pattern.
To be human algorithms.
Why
yeah.
not?
Just like pattern
more
recognition.
Eyes.
Just tell us if you see anything unusual, and then we'll flag that for closer examination. Yeah.
Now, George, keep in mind.
Then we'll say it's aliens.
Yeah.
Keep in mind, these planet hunters, when they work together, going through the Kepler data, together, they make Voltron! No. But together, they can actually sift through even more data than the algorithms could, because in this particular instance, human beings, the human eye and the human mind are still way better than any algorithms right. we can create.
Analog,
so far.
Baby.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So we're analog still beats out computer here and there. And this is a perfect example. So in 2011, many of the citizen scientists commented. They were like, hey, you know, we've all looked at this one. And you know what? That particular star that's 1,480 light years away with KIC 8462852 found in the Cygnus constellation. It's weird. Something very weird is going on. They used the words bizarre and interesting and weird.
Nice.
And this is because the star had a light pattern that was different from all the other stars that they were observing. It wasn't the typical dip in light. Mm-hmm. There was something else even more weird than just this, you know, dip in the light. So
I'm not a typical dip.
dip. So
dip.
Typically, if they're looking at a star that was a young star, then there could be some type of disk of debris around the star because the solar system is still forming. The planets haven't fully formed, you know, but of course, over time, the debris collects and forms into planets and rings around planets and ice and, you know, asteroids or whatever, demons, you know, all sorts of things come out with it. So the
Fruit Loops, Nerf.
Yeah, Nerf balls everywhere. So the Kepler scientists were able to determine, though, that this was not a young star. So, and this is awesome. I did not know that this is one of the things that they did. This was because the star wasn't emitting extra infrared light due to the light interacting with that space dust. So they're like, wait, if this were a young star and what we're seeing is space dust that hasn't coalesced into planets yet, it would be obscuring the light and we would see more infrared light because that's what happens. That's not what was happening. So it's very unlikely that there was space dust to begin with. And it would have been like ridiculously lucky for us to like be looking at the solar system in that stage in that brief amount of time from an astronomical perspective. It's very unlikely it was random debris or anything. So to get to what the scientists have to say, so Tabitha Boyajian, that's a really cool name, is a postdoc at Yale who manages the Planet Hunter's efforts, and she published a paper offering some explanations about what was observed. So this is what she's saying. Okay, here's a whole bunch of things that this could be. It could be instrumentation error. It could be debris from asteroids that have smacked into each other. It could be an impact on the planetary scale, right? So this is where, you know, two giant bodies smack into each other and boom, you know, the enough dirt is thrown up into the orbit of something to make a moon or whatever, you know, like a big, big impact type thing. Another thing is like a stray star goes through that solar system or near it, and it has collected a whole bunch of comets. And then because of the near star interaction, the other star captured some of the comets.
Okay. Pulled them in close.
Yeah. Yes. Now that last one is actually the most likely thing, but even still, that's
remarkable.
That's very unlikely. Very, very unlikely. So the other ones weren't even solid. Those were explanations, but they weren't even considered likely or solid either. So none of these really did it. You know, they just don't feel like they've landed it. So, you know, okay, so we have to keep our minds open, guys, right? We're not talking, this is not science fiction. This is possible, really. So another astronomer, Jason Wright from Penn State University in the United States, you know, he's considering, is this a giant alien structure orbiting that star?
Mm.
You know, what is this? You know, he wondered, is it solar collectors? Whatever. So listen to what Wright had to say. He said, when Boyajian showed me the data, I was fascinated by how crazy it looked. He said, aliens should always be the very last hypothesis you consider, but this looked like something you would expect an alien civilization to build. Whoa, that's a pretty profound statement.
Wow.
Lots of skeptical flags go up, right, guys? You can feel them popping left and right.
Oh, sure. It's speculation. Well, it's
speculation.
But, yeah,
it reminded me instantly of the LGM, right, Little Green Men, when we first saw pulsars, which have a regular rhythm to them. So that's too regular for any natural phenomena. Maybe it's alien. But that was just filling that's the alien of the gaps argument, right? Basically, we don't know what this thing is. It's weird. We can't figure it out.
Therefore,
maybe it's aliens.
It's weird and pissed off.
Yeah. So I suspect this is not aliens, that this is going to be something, just a normal astronomical event. The idea that it's very unlikely to be a really unlikely event, or it's the kind of thing that only would exist for a short period of time astronomically, I get that. But when you're looking at 150,000 stars, you're going to see really rare things, right?
Right.
Sure. So you have to consider, it works both ways. You know, it's a law of large numbers working both ways. So I'm not sure that argument statistically holds water. You know, it's like we're going to find rare stuff when you're looking at 150,000 stars.
I agree. But Steve, it's okay, though, to put it into the loop. Like, let's not.
Sure. I hope it is. Wouldn't that be awesome? You know, whatever.
How cool is it that, first off, like, okay, number one, that they can monitor a star, which is 1,400 light years away. Is that what it is? 1,400? 1,200? Yeah. Whatever it is. And notice slight anomalous behavior. Like, just that is pretty awesome.
I'm with you, George. Exactly.
And the second thing is, like, if we do discover aliens, I think this is how it's going to happen. It's going to be this slow. It's not going to be like they're not going to land on the lawn of the White House. You know, it's going to be this.
Damn.
Well, it could be. And like a year is going to go by and it's like, well, it sort of might be. And then like another year, you know, like, you know what I mean? It's
going to
be this slow creep. And then it'll just be like, most people won't believe it. And then it'll be like 50-50 and then 60-40. And then in 20, 30 years, it'll be accepted. Like, yeah, this is an alien civilization. We will never be able to contact. They will never be able to contact us. Blah, 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 blah. But I think that's how it's going to happen. It won't be this like, yay!
That will be.
Yeah, I hear you.
It's going to be the discovery, though.
Right.
Absolutely.
Because it's such a low probability and so dramatic, it'll take years for them to like, just slowly check other explanations off the list. One, until there's no other viable option. And then you'd have to say, okay, this is the only thing that's left that we are aware of at this time. So we've got to give
some unknown.
We've got to give some extra credence to it. It would take a while before we, unless it was just way too dramatic to be anything else. But yeah, it would take a while.
I think they're taking the next appropriate step. So Boyajian Wright and Andrew Simeon, who is the director of SETI Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley, they're writing a proposal so they can point a big radio dish at the weird star.
Nice.
See if,
if
it's emitting radio waves.
I mean, you should at least do that. Absolutely.
And they're going to look to see if it's emitting radio waves that have a technological bend to them, right?
Right.
So they know.
Yes, right.
Now, keep this in mind, guys. Mm-hmm. Check this out. We have a bubble of radio waves that is constantly leaving the Earth and constantly expanding. Oh, yeah. And what is it, Steve, that we talked about today? 70 light years of bubble surrounding the Earth
Something like that. So TV,
it's
radio
been like that,
in the 40s.
The 30s, 40s.
Yeah, so that's a really big broadcast that we're sending out to our galaxy. If this is alien technology, we might be able to detect their emissions because their radio waves have hit us. And we're hoping to get a first look as soon as January 2016 with a bigger dish, guys. So it's, you know, we're going to see this, you know.
What's interesting, though, what Seth told us when he was on the show one of the previous times we interviewed him, is that if we ever did pick up an interesting signal that was an alien signal candidate, we would actually then have to build a dedicated radio dish to be able to listen in with enough fidelity to actually interpret it. Imagine the nail-biting delay that would be. It's like, oh, this is such a good candidate for an alien signal. Now we got to spend 5 years building a dish that could actually, intercept it with enough fidelity that we could listen in on it. Because our current dishes wouldn't cut it. They wouldn't even do it.
Not sensitive enough.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, and luckily this is fairly close. It's not like it's 100,000 light years away or even farther. So the fact that it's really only, 1,400 or so light years, that's relatively damn close.
If they're looking at us, they're seeing our, the beginning of our dark ages and stuff. 600, 700, not the best time in human history. Hmm. They might be like, oh man, what's going on there?
Like Trelane.
Right. Yes. Right. Yeah, exactly.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, The Great Courses.
Guys, I really enjoyed watching the series about Einstein's Relativity and the Quantum Revolution, Modern Physics for Non-Scientists by Professor Richard Wolfson. And we have talked about him before on the show. We've talked about this particular course on the show. It is really great.
Yeah, this is a great intro course to everything you ever wanted to know about relativity and quantum mechanics. He goes through the history of how these ideas developed. At several points in his lecture, he says, now, if you don't agree with this interpretation, you need to come up with another one that explains all of the experimental data. He shows you how unavoidable the conclusions of relativity and quantum mechanics are. And I really appreciate that. It really helps you wrap your head around why physicists think what they do.
The Great Courses is celebrating their 25th anniversary. That means that they have compiled a list of over 500 different subjects, including science, math, history, art, and a lot more. The cool thing about the Great Courses is, of course, they get it to you in any way you want. You want it in a DVD, CDs, you could stream it, digital download. There's apps that you could use.
There's an app for that?
So we have a special one-time limited offer for our listeners on this course. Order from 8 of the Great Courses best-selling series, including Einstein's Relativity and the Quantum Revolution, at up to 80% off the original price.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, let's go on. So very interesting neurology item this week. I just couldn't resist talking about a paper. The paper itself is, again, it's one incremental study, but the topic is so fascinating. So researchers have been looking at trying to figure out what is the cause for hallucinations. So by definition, hallucinations are sensory perceptions that are not based in reality, right? They're not there. So it's when you think you see or hear or sense something that is not based on actual stimuli. An illusion is when you misinterpret stimuli, right? So if you are getting some stimulation, but you're interpreting it differently, that's an illusion. If you are seeing somebody who isn't there at all, that's a hallucination.
Okay. So pareidolia would be an illusion.
Yeah, right. One of the big questions is, of course, just why do people experience hallucinations? Obviously, it's by definition, it's part of a psychotic disorder. So people who, for example, are schizophrenic will frequently hear voices. So one neurological question is, just phenomenologically with hallucinations, do people who have hallucinations, do they have increased tendency to perceive things or just a decreased ability to filter out the ones that are not real, right? Is it due to impaired reality testing, or are they generating more of these hallucinogenic experiences? The authors of the current study, these are researchers from Cambridge and Cardiff Universities in the UK, were testing a very specific hypothesis. They think that the hallucinations may simply be a manifestation of a normal, healthy processing that the brain does. So what they say is that hallucinations are actually necessary for us to make sense of the world in a way.
Ooh, fills gaps?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, that our perceptions are terrible, right? Think about your visual perceptions. You have a sharp image in if you hold your thumb out at arm's length, your thumbnail, everything outside of that thumbnail, you're basically legally blind. Everything outside of your thumbnail held at arm's length is a blur. So how is it that we can perceive and interact with the world when our actual visual perception is so horribly blurred and low resolution? Also, think about this. We've mentioned this on the show before. Because there's a delay in our processing, you're perceiving the world from 60 milliseconds ago or 100 milliseconds ago, which doesn't sound like a lot, but try to catch a baseball when you're delayed by 100 milliseconds. So our brains are actually extrapolating a little bit into the future. And they're taking the blurry, imperfect, ambiguous stimuli, and they're making the best fit for that based upon our prior knowledge. So the researchers refer to this as top-down processing. You start with our understanding of the world, our prior knowledge, and those hierarchically higher brain regions actually control how the more basic, hierarchically lower brain regions process sensory information. So that's top-down influence of the way our brains construct our visual perceptions, our sensory perceptions. The bottom-up process is sensory information comes in, and then it gets progressively constructed into an image. You know, more and more the processing gets more and more refined until, you know, first you see shapes, then you see the three-dimensionality, and then it's an object, and then that object has meaning. Whereas the top-down is, all right, I know what the object looks like, so I'm going to tweak how my brain's constructing the image so it fits the object I think I'm seeing. Does that make sense? So there's this simultaneously, there's this sort of top-down and bottom-up process, constructive process that meets in the middle is one way to think of it.
Well, Steve, what about this? We all, every one of us, hallucinate convincingly every night when we dream. Yeah. Does that play a factor as well into this?
It's hard to say because that's a different brain state. It's literally an altered brain state. So mm-hmm. it doesn't necessarily mean that that's the way your brain functions when you're awake. So let's put that aside because that's a variable they didn't address, and it just is a complexity that I don't think is necessarily analogous, but it's an interesting point.
So is it where those two systems meet? That's what affects how much someone will hallucinate? Like if it's more top down, then they hallucinate more?
Exactly. If it's more top down, they hallucinate more, right? So that's their hypothesis, that maybe people who have a tendency to hallucinate, the balance between top down control and bottom up construction is just shifted to the top down. So they set out to test that in this way. They did two studies really. They did one with people who had an early diagnosis of psychosis who were not yet diagnosed and treated. So these are untreated individuals because they didn't want medications to interfere with their testing. So they had psychosis, but they're not a formal diagnosis and they were untreated compared to healthy controls. And then they took people who were healthy, who didn't have a disorder, but who tested higher on the tendency to have psychosis compared to people who tested lower. And then they gave them a test. They showed them a black and white two-dimensional image of some picture. Now, when you look at this, you just see noise. You really have no chance of being able to see what the picture is of. It's just too little information. But if you are shown the color version of the photo, like the full color version, you could easily see what it is. That primes you. Now that gives you the prior knowledge that you can use to construct the image into at least understanding what the image is of. You have to actually just see the pictures to really understand what I'm talking about. Right? So they showed the subjects black and white image that were just noise and ones that were black and white, two-tone versions of an actual image. And then, you know, there's people couldn't make sense of them. And then they showed them batches of pictures, some of which matched the black and white images that they were looking at. So they were primed, right? So now they have the prior knowledge and they can use that to identify the black and white pictures. It's hard, even when you see the picture and then it's hard to recognize what you're seeing in the black and white picture, but you can do it. So the question was, were people who had hallucinations, were they better able to use their top-down prior knowledge in order to construct these very low-res images? And their hypothesis was, yes, that if hallucinations are a manifestation of this normal brain function of top-down control from prior knowledge, then they should do better on this task. And that's exactly what they found, that they did better at constructing these pictures. So it's hard to interpret this too specifically because the brain is so complicated. There's so many other things going on here, but their predictions were verified by their experiments. So it does seem that, and this is, I think, a reasonable explanatory approach in neuroscience, is that when you're looking at a disorder, to rather than thinking this is something that's broken, you could think of it as this is a normal function of the brain that's just out of its optimal parameter.
Yeah, or hypersensitive or something.
Yeah, it's like anxiety. Anxiety, you can't live without anxiety, right? Somebody who completely lacked anxiety, that's a disorder. You wouldn't get out of bed. Like you wouldn't look both ways before you cross the street. But there's a certain sweet spot where anxiety is functional. If you have too much anxiety, then it becomes a disorder, right? You have an anxiety disorder. So anxiety isn't the brain broken. It's just it's out of its optimal parameters. They said maybe the same thing is true of hallucinations. The top-down control is just too high. So you're using your prior knowledge to construct sensory information that doesn't even add up to anything, and you're constructing into people and voices and what.
I love when they come up with a way to test this kind of stuff, and it always blows my mind. Like Steve, you as a neuro person, could you have come up with this test? Like, if you had, the next 5 months you've got to work on developing a test for this hypothesis. Do you think you would have come up with something like that?
Yeah, this isn't too far out of what I'm used to, because I've read so many of these studies. This is an iteration of a type of test. But you're right. That, George, is the genius of researchers.
Oh, my God.
Figuring out how to test a hypothesis.
Every time you think there's no way you can test this thing, whatever that thing may be, you just think it's too obscure. There's too many variables. Yeah. And they come up with something and you go, oh yeah, that's a good way to do it.
That's the cleverness. That's like the coolest thing. George?
Every time.
It is genius.
That is the creative cleverness of researchers.
Oh, I love it.
Is figuring out a clever, elegant way of testing a hypothesis.
Elegant.
Yeah.
Good word.
Yeah.
Perfect word for it. Yeah.
Exactly. Oh yeah. That's exactly it. And this is a very interesting test because they're saying, yeah, that they're shifted towards this top-down construction. But again, this is one of those studies that's going to spawn many more follow-up studies to really start to sort this out.
So then how would you treat this? Is this a visual concern? If you wore glasses that somehow limited the information, like it would help? Or is this
I don't think so.
More like a synapse thing that you have to kind of fix from the inside out?
Yeah, I think you got it. It's because it's top-down. That's the whole point.
Okay.
It's not bottom-up. It's the top-down process that's the problem. So that's what you got to fix. Right now we just basically dull it with medications. It's crude. The medications are very crude and the side effects are terrible. But it's better than hallucinating horribly, but it's still.
Yeah, debilitating.
Yeah, but people do not like being on the medications, I got to tell you. They don't like not being on them either. I mean, it's really.
Right.
It's a terrible choice. But then it depends on how much insight they have, because when they're not on medication, they don't want to be on medication. And then when they're on medication, they're like, I feel like crap, but I know I need to be on the medication. We really do need better ways of treating these types of psychotic disorders. We really, really do. And drugs may just not, we just may not have the receptors to do it. You know what I mean? We can only, the drugs have to work on receptors that are there. And if there aren't a population of receptors that will do what we want precisely enough, a pharmacological approach may never exist. So that's where we need to hack the brain, right? We need to insert chips in the brain that
Could you see a surgical solution? I mean, could you envision that happening in the next 50 years?
Correct. 50 years, sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Not a crude surgical. So that's like a frontal lobotomy kind of approach. Not just a
right,
but, not a surgery, a brain machine interface solution.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, a compensator or
that's going to like what else. It'll limit certain neurons from firing.
Shift that balance more towards the optimal level.
Yeah.
But
wow.
The way I think about this is that I think this is actually a reasonable bottom line take home for all this is that your everyday experience is a hallucination. It's just a functional hallucination that has a practical relationship to reality.
Right,
and the
right.
problem with people who have a hallucination disorder is that their hallucinations are not practical. They don't have a relationship to reality. They're just too far shifted towards what's being generated in their own head versus what's out there. And then illusions are kind of in the middle, you know. They're easier to understand, where hallucinations, there's this other thing, this top-down process.
So would we ever be able to create receptors in the brain? Like, you want to customize your own handcrafted receptor to do a specific thing. Is that like crazy out of the realm of possibility?
Then you're talking about genetic engineering at that point, okay. Basically, which is not out of the realm, but that's the level of intervention that you're talking about. You're changing the neurons, you're changing their genes so it produces a specific receptor that you could then manipulate.
Like, you want to see spiders everywhere, Jay? Is that what you're going for?
Exactly. Well, it's Halloween, so I just want it for a month.
Okay, nice. Nice. Well,
Bob can help perfect. You with that.
Think about it. I mean, anytime. There are drugs that are hallucinogens, right? That's actually easier. It's actually easier to make that happen.
Yeah. Right.
You
know,
you take hallucinogenics and boom, it just, you're off. And what's happening there?
Oh, so that's what's happening there. It's just sort of like,
it's throwing the balance out.
Yeah. So then all of a sudden you're seeing light trails and all that kind of, oh, wow.
Yeah. But again, I still think there's this reality testing component, which is a separate phenomenon. And I think different people might hallucinate for different reasons. You know what I mean? It may not be one phenomenon that we're looking at.
Right.
And I do think, like with dreaming, Bob, since you bring that up, when we're dreaming, I think our reality testing is decreased. That's why dreams make sense to you, and then when you wake up, they don't make sense to you because now you're
gosh, that's so frustrating.
It's a different brain. You're using it's a different mind that's assessing it. Yeah, no, it's weird. I recently I've been having a lot of dreams that I remember, and it's like in the dream, the weirdest crap makes total sense to me.
I know. Why aren't I questioning this after you wake up? It's like, why didn't I think to think differently?
Well, Evan, it's
about
a matter
this?
Of, I think one way to look at it is that you don't have the critical threshold of neurons firing in the frontal lobe, say, that would let you say, oh, wait, a pink elephant in a supermarket? That's not right.
All right, Jay, before we go on to our big discussion about sci-fi movies, you're going to get us up to date on Who's That Noisy?
Last week, I played yet another blaster sound. And unfortunately, for my co-host, no one really guessed it. I'm going to give you guys another chance.
Okay.
Here's the sound.
It's a blaster.
It's so familiar, but it's, I just is not locking it in place.
It's one of the Star Wars blasters, isn't it, Jay?
Yeah, it is. Okay.
Yeah, it sounds Star Warsy.
It's the AT-AT. It's nope. the 10X HUD Cruft Muncher.
The HUD 7. No, that
it's a hand blaster.
You know, not a blaster of big kind. It's only the freaking Han Solo blaster DL-44 that I never stop talking about. Yes, that's it. That is the blaster.
but yours doesn't make that sound, does it, Jay?
Evan, that's it. That I got that off of StarWars.com. That's the Han Solo blaster.
Seems very long. It seems like a very long tail to it. For
it does
be
because
Han
it's uninterrupted. It's unsullied by other sound effects and music.
Oh.
By other inferior noises.
Now, if you shoot a blaster multiply in succession, does each blast have that long tail to it, or does the mechanism of the blaster like reset
All right, you know what I mean? From a sound perspective, yeah, the gun would just
from a Foley perspective, like is each shot going pew or is it pew pew pew?
So you're talking about like this. I'm not joking, but I can do this. You're talking about this effect. Right?
Right. There you
go. I'm like, I'm just jamming on the button and it's starting over, starting over, starting over. No, I think a real Foley artist would have some type of tail to every initiated sound. But you never know. If you have 30 blasts going on at the same time, you know.
Because that sounded like a ship flying by doing multiple blasts on the Death Star or something where it goes pew, 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 pew.
Why don't we look into that and talk about it again?
Okay.
All right. So check this out. Here's another one. I gave a little bit more there because I wanted people to have a little bit more of a chance of guessing.
That's Han Solo's beard trimmer. No? Maybe not.
I would like
his Wookiee trimmer. Yeah.
Justice Smith from Wellington, New Zealand, did guess that that was Han Solo's blaster. He was the first. Congratulations.
Yay.
Well, you should
probably contact me and you and I will talk all things Star Wars, Justice.
don't do it. Don't do it.
All right. So please guess that. That particular blaster-like weapon. And I do have a very interesting sound that I would like to play this week as well. Check this out. The question on that one is, what made the sound? So, guys, please guess. Please send me in your noisy ideas to WTN@theskepticsguide.org. And please do, if you want to send me any cool blaster sounds that you like that I haven't played yet, send them to me. Talk to me. Send me pictures of your animals. But please do not send me any pictures of Evan before 1982.
Or me.
Or Evan.
Don't send them to me either. I don't want to see those.
An unabridged version of the next discussion is available on premium content. So I'm just going to be playing about a 20-minute excerpt from this longer discussion that we had about sci-fi movies, but the full discussion is over an hour. So if you want to listen to the full discussion, you could download that from our premium content. If you're not already a premium member, please take a look at our membership page. For as little as $8 a month, you could be a premium member and get access to all sorts of extra content, including extended segments and interviews like the following. Hope you enjoy. Well, let's go on to your questions and emails. We have one question this week. This comes from Lucas Jones from Savannah, Tennessee. And Lucas writes, I think it was episode 533 or right close to that, but Jay made the joke about having a dream, nightmare for Kara, about her having to watch 30 straight hours of the core science fiction TV shows and movies. I am 29, so just a few years younger, but I lucked out growing up with a family that had movie night and with a father that loved science fiction. I was wondering what all you guys would include as the core science fiction. I have a fall break coming up with school and would love to make sure I fill in the voids of films that I haven't seen during that break. Thanks again for a great show, everyone. Well, Lucas, we're so glad you asked us that question.
Is that quick? All? This is like 30 seconds. We'll be good to go. So,
yeah.
All right. In fact, we want to give you a thorough answer to this question. So we invited a friend of ours who has been on the show before, who happens to be a published award-winning science fiction author, Brian Trent. Brian, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. So good to be here again.
Brian!
So,
Brian!
Hey,
everybody.
Tell everyone a little bit about what you've published so far.
Well, work of mine has appeared in Analog and Galaxy's Edge. It's actually been a great trip this year alone, seeing a lot of publications featuring my work, and I get to explore all the spectrum of sci-fi, hard sci-fi, a little bit of fantasy, although I'm more of a nuts and bolts kind of guy, so... And occasionally straying into that Venn diagram where it crosses into sci-fi horror, which I imagine we're going to talk about today, too.
Sure, sure. Yeah, so this is such a fun idea that we might actually break this up and do multiple different categories. For tonight, we're just going to do science fiction movies. But let's talk a little bit about what criteria we use to decide what is the best science fiction movie. Like, for example, obviously just a great film, a great work of cinematic art.
And whether or not it's 2001, I think, is the key thing.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes.
But also, was it enjoyable to watch? Was it memorable? Like, here I am in 2015 thinking about what science fiction movies I've seen over my life, and the ones that most readily come to mind are the best ones because I could think of them off the top of my head, you know?
Yeah. Entertaining. Right,
or the most horrific.
Well, there's a couple of
words. There's a few.
Not hard. And also, I think it's kind of it's interesting to ponder the fact that some of these movies I've not seen in literally decades, and I have such nostalgic memories, loved them as a kid, but if I watched it again, I would be like, what the hell was I thinking? And not so much that my appreciation has changed, but also the culture has changed in such a way that it's just not considered the movie at all that it was. For example, I remember bringing my daughter to see E.T. How classic is E.T.? How awesome is E.T. when that came out in the early 80s? I saw that 10 years ago and I was like, what the hell? The pacing was completely off. So does that impact your assessment of the movie? Or
Yes. Absolutely. Did it hold up over time? Did it hold up over time? Which makes it harder to judge the recent movies. But
sure.
You know, it's a movie from the 70s that totally held up gets absolutely extra credit for that. I would also say impact on the culture and impact on film, impact on the industry.
And that's why,
absolutely,
Steve, that's why I just have to come out swinging and say that Star Wars, it has to be in the number one slot.
Does anyone disagree with that?
I would disagree with that. I would say 2001 in terms of its influence. It came before it everything after it. It's like, to me, in film, there is everything before 2001 in science fiction, and there's everything after 2001 in science fiction.
That's a good point, because if you think of a lot of the 50s and 60s sci-fi, it was pretty cheesy with very
bad
few
science.
Exceptions. With
Forbidden
few
Planet.
Exceptions.
Forbidden
yes,
Planet being
that's
exceptions.
The
yeah, well,
one.
That's the one.
Yeah. I would argue that's
but that's pretty cheesy.
That's a demarcation line.
It's campy. Forbidden Planet is campy.
It's
in
campy.
A good way. It's fun to watch. It's retro. It's wonderfully retro.
Yeah, but I will look, I love 2001 for what it is, and I can appreciate it on many levels, but I can't sit down and watch that movie over and over and over again.
I can and I have. You're wrong, Jay. Listen, one other thing, because we mentioned Star Wars right out of the gate. I think that we're going to consider franchises as one thing, just so that we don't get bogged down.
I don't agree.
Because Star Wars, the third Star Wars, man, Star Wars Return of the Jedi, it starts to lose its sheen. It starts to lose its. It's nowhere
well,
near
I agree
as
with that.
You can take
sure.
that. You can take that into consideration when judging the entire franchise. But I think I don't want to list like four Star Wars movies in our top 10.
Right.
That's what I want to avoid doing.
Okay. I get that. I don't want to do that either. But I think, like, as an example, Wrath of Khan to me was the only really good Star Trek movie, and
I agree.
The vast majority of the other ones. I would rather just list Star Trek Wrath of Khan and not list all of Star Trek movies.
Well, yeah. But
it's a much
more defined.
That's a lot of movies.
Let's get back to number one. Anyone else have a vote for number one? Jay is Star Wars. George is 2001. Bob, Evan, Brian?
Well, if we're including, this I would say, if we're including Star Wars, which, you know, you can't actually debate it because Star Wars is, you know, pulp, it's space opera. But I mean, if we're considering space opera a subset of science fiction, I would say in terms of how it holds up, I would say in terms of influence, yeah, I would have to put the original trilogy in the number one spot.
Sure. The impact that it had on all of us growing up, I don't think can be understated. I can't think of a movie as an 8-year-old boy that I watched that had more of an influence on my interest in science fiction than that movie. And I always find myself pointing back to that movie at some point in all these years since then.
But guys,
so I have to put it there.
Is it more fantasy than science fiction, though? When you're dealing with the force,
it's several things.
You know, you're dealing with the force is that main idea that's there, and there's tech in there, which is very, very shaky in terms of, you know, they're really pushing what that tech can be.
Hey, so George.
Yeah.
Listen, we already talked
you're
about
right.
this.
You're
we,
right.
We've already decided to include things that you know you might want to exclude for whatever reason, but we're putting together the best list we can. So
I know, but number one slot. That's what I'm saying. That if it's going to be in the absolute tip top number one slot for science fiction, I mean, I, Number two, I would totally give it to you, but to be number one in science fiction, to me, 2001 is as pure a science fiction story as you can have. There's fantastic elements to it in terms of the aliens. There is the time spanning nature of the multiple, arcs to the stories, the multiple acts. There is supernatural almost stuff, but still kind of explainable in terms of the alien tech. I mean, to me, that is the ultimate science fiction film that not only is the ultimate science fiction film, it's sort of the really very, very first science fiction film.
There are no blasters in that movie.
So, well, yeah,
let me defend George. I agree because it was the first modern, really science fiction movie. Obviously, I'm biased because I'm a Kubrick fan and it's my favorite movie, but things you don't even realize. That, like, before 2001, movies didn't really use a music score the way that 2001 did. Kubrick was the first one to really powerfully use music in a movie the way that he did, combining the music with the images.
But yet,
he took it to the next level.
Can you sing? Can you vocalize every freaking song in that movie like you can to the Star Wars music?
Yes, Jay, when I hear the Blue Danube, I think of spaceships.
Yeah, but it doesn't even come close to the Star Wars original music.
It's different, Jay. I don't know. It's transcendent.
Well, 2001 is definitely... I mean, George, I actually agree to a point with you that, I mean, there's a much purer sense of science. I mean, you had Arthur C. Clarke co-writing the screenplay. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But... the thing, too, is there's a fair amount of magic in there. Now, Arthur C. Clarke's work themselves, when he talked about aliens, he had this cosmic, almost like deity-like quality to his aliens.
They were godlike aliens. Sure.
Yes,
no question. But they're still aliens. They're still aliens. You don't need to invoke supernaturalism.
Right. Yeah. All right, let me jump in. I'm going to back up Jay on this a little bit. Steve and Gio, I understand, of course, 2001 is an epic movie and it had a huge impact. But when you consider Star Wars, the impact on the culture, I think, absolutely blows away the impact on the culture that 2001.
I'll give you that too.
Right, you don't have people dressing up as monoliths for Halloween.
And you also say that it was the first modern sci-fi movie. I agree, but if you look at the time span between 2001 and Star Wars, 2001 is almost an anomaly, whereas after Star Wars, that's when that caused a bigger, more immediate explosion.
What
immediate
you're supposed to say is, Bob, is that it was ahead of its time. But I agree. the effect of Star Wars was on the culture was greater. Star Wars changed the look of technology in our culture. After Star Wars, technology was black. It was never black before Star Wars. They changed the look of our technology. Oh yeah, and there are so many iconic things in Star Wars, like Darth Vader is the iconic villain. You just can't get around that. Absolutely, I will grant you that. Although I think that the entire persona of Hal, that had a profound, how many Hals have there been in science fiction after that movie?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think, and that's one of the criteria. When you create an entire iconic thing that then resonates throughout, you know, fiction after you, that gives you huge props.
Sure. Well, you know, to that point, Steve, I just wanted to add one thing about Hal, because he's actually one of my favorite science fiction characters. I wanted to give a shout-out to 2010, which doesn't get a lot of love, but Hal is explored so well, mm-hmm. and actually, in a lot of ways, I think his character is much more refined and more described in 2010 than in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
There's some great moments.
Let's poke our heads out of the weeds now. I think we need to just land Star Wars, the original trilogy, in the number one slot and move forward.
All right. Well, it's 3-2 is from what I'm hearing. So we got Star Wars 1, 2001 A Space Odyssey 2.
All right. Slot number 3.
What are the other three movies? We won't need to put them in order, but what are the other three movies that will crack our top 5?
I was going to say, too, right, I actually love Forbidden Planet. I know there's some cheesy elements to it, but there's so many, the Krell, the size of them, the size of their machines, there's so many classic science fiction tropes that are in that movie. And
right.
The scene when that creature and the monster of the id attacks the camp with the force
fields. It's horrifying.
Is incredible.
It is, and you could say that was ahead of its time. I mean, this
and
was
Robbie
made
the
in
Robot.
The 50s.
Robbie the Robot, again, iconic. Absolutely.
Oh, man.
I think followed after it. I know.
Forbidden Planet is the
pinnacle retro sci-fi movie.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
it
absolutely.
definitely needs to be in the top 10. Not sure it'd crack my top 5.
What about Day the Earth Stood Still?
Ooh.
Robert Wise.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, that's also...
Robert Wise is...
also good.
I'm so biased against 50s movies, except for this
I think Alien perhaps should go.
You think Alien in the top 5?
In the top 5. Yeah, yeah. I know we're now treading into sort of the horror realm.
That's okay. Sci-fi horror is okay.
Oh, it's science fiction.
But it Alien did to me what The Shining did to me, but you know, the Alien did it with spaceships and in outer space. I was so afraid and at the same time captivated by what was going on that I watched it and watched it again and again. I couldn't get enough of it, and I think a lot of people had that same.
I don't know.
Emotional
this
reaction
is this is
it.
Tricky because for me, Aliens was that movie.
Okay. Yeah.
We'll consider them together, Alien and Alien.
Oh, okay.
Really? Okay. Yeah. Wow. All right.
Actually, as a franchise, the Alien franchise. Just like.
Well, if we're talking franchise, I this might not be popular, but I got to make a push for the Back to the Future films. I think in the top 5.
Oh,
I think
man.
That redefined how people thought about time travel and the paradoxes of time travel, and they were incredibly entertaining films.
Yeah.
And I think all three
so much fun.
All three hold up and that sequel, I think, is one of the best sequels that actually goes into the first movie and it actually sort of enters itself. Yeah,
yes.
That had never been done before, and I think that in terms of a time traveling science fiction trope is a really brilliant way to do it. Yes, there's all kinds of weirdness in terms of its time not making sense or whatever, but
it doesn't make sense
but to have three films that and then that I defend the third film also. I think it was a great idea to take to get outside of itself and make a little bit of a cowboy western. They're just fun. I would totally put that in the top 5.
Well, I'm still going to make the argument for Forbidden Planet or
I vote for Forbidden Planet for 3 as well. That's 2 votes for Forbidden Planet.
I'd say the Alien franchise.
I'm going to say the Matrix.
Oh,
actually, it's on my list.
Wow.
The first one.
Effect on filmmaking and the culture was massive.
Yes.
I just watched The Matrix again with my daughter, who loves it. Captivated a new generation. You watch that movie and you realize how much influence it had. Think about all the innovations in that movie. The
bullet
sort
cam.
Of the stopping
bullet
the action and,
yeah.
and the camera moving around, the look, the bullet cam, yeah. All of that. In fact, like one point my daughter's like, oh, that's where that's from. She's seen it so many places. And now she's remembering what the origin of that cliche was. That had a profound effect on science fiction movies. The first movie also was a masterpiece. It was obviously a Christian allegory from beginning to end, but it was really, the whole story was wonderful, you know, in terms of that kind of a story. They pulled it off fantastically. And there are scenes like when he wakes up in the pod for the first time and he,
right.
that moment in the movie, there's how many cinema moments are like that?
And actually, Steve, there's some really creepy moments of foreshadowing. I've seen it so many times. There's a scene when he is, before he wakes up, he's in his boss's office getting dressed down for being late again. And he's paying attention to the window wipers. It's making this odd streaking sound. And he's obviously disturbed by it. And then when he's actually being flushed out of the pod later, it makes the same sound. It's like this really creepy, oddly subtle foreshadowing. A lot of thought went into every frame of that movie.
Wow, yeah. Brian, like, because he's heard other people get flushed.
Yeah.
Or
what
his body
hell?
is brushing up against the glass. There was a lot, every single scene was very pregnant with a lot of in terms of cinematography, in terms of the effect, in terms of the storyboarding.
It's one of the best ever ways to explain superpowers too, in terms of it's like a legitimate way you stretch the matrix, and it allows you to enjoy the crazy kung fu by not being like, oh geez, please. You get to go, oh no, he's learning how to stretch the matrix.
Matrix, George.
I'd say Matrix.
Bob?
It's like picking my kids. How the hell am I going to do this?
Got to make a decision, Bob.
Selfish choice.
God. All right, Evan.
Matrix. Matrix.
Aliens.
All right, it's got to be the Matrix then.
Okay.
All right.
But I think Forbidden Planet is top 10. I think Alien Aliens is top 10.
Terminator 2.
Terminator
1 and 2.
You think top 10?
Terminator.
Oh, my God, yes. Terminator 2 and Aliens 3 are like
influential.
Epic science fiction.
Also, one of those things that George was talking about with the analysis of time travel. Certainly, the first two Terminator films.
Yeah,
But right, I put the aliens duology above them, though.
We're on to four now. We have one, two, and three. We have two more slots for the top five. What are they going to be?
Day of the Earth is still.
We're at five, guys. Right now, we have Star Wars, 2001, and The Matrix. That's one, two, and three. For slots four and five, we've been heavily arguing about Forbidden Planet, Back to the Future, and Aliens.
Can I make a case for Planet of the Apes, the original?
Yeah, that's definitely on my list. Mm-hmm. I think that would be.
And maybe it doesn't make five.
I think it's top 20.
It's close.
I think it's top 20.
Yeah, top 20 on my list.
So let's just focus on the next two best films to hit that top five list.
Dune and Blade Runner. We got to. They're in my top 10. We have to think about them for
Blade
top
Runner,
five.
Blade Runner.
I would go Alien much faster than Dune. It's much more entertaining as a film. Dune, there's great ideas there, but if it's really it's tough to watch sometimes.
And you're talking about the film Dune, not the mini series.
Am I wrong?
On sci-fi.
You are wrong. Yes, the film. You're objectively wrong. Listen,
maybe I gotta watch it again. Then I gotta watch
Dune
it again.
Dune is a cult classic.
Yeah.
It's a cult classic. It's a beautiful, beautiful film.
I'll give you that. It looks beautiful.
The
yes.
casting is wonderful. The acting is wonderful, and it gets props from me because more than almost any other of the top science fiction movies I could think of, it was so true to the book in the look and feel of the way the technology was supposed to look. It's a completely analog world in the distant future with no computers, no digital technology. And David Lynch totally captured that. For that reason, you know, as a work of science fiction film art, it is a masterpiece in my opinion.
I would say top 20, but in terms of its influence, I mean, Alien, Terminator, way more influential, more successful.
I agree with the influence argument.
I think I can argue that I've watched the Dune movie more than everybody here. Like, I watch it four or five times a year. I'm in love with it. But yeah, I mean, absolute love of that movie. But I have enough sense to know that it probably doesn't belong in the top five. So, guys, number four.
It's got to be in the top 10.
It is in the top 10. Number four, I'm putting a bid in for Forbidden Planet.
So am I.
I could live with that.
Wait, that's three votes.
Wait, so what do we have here? We got Star Wars 1, 2001, 2. What was 3 and 4?
The Matrix is 3, Forbidden Planet 4, and Alien. I think Forbidden Planet and Aliens 4 and 5, we could move on to the next 5. I think we're good. All right, so let's read the whole list.
All right, so here's what we got, guys. We're almost at a lock. Ready?
Hit it.
Star Wars, 2001 A Space Odyssey, The Matrix, Forbidden Planet, Alien, and Aliens, you know, including the franchises here. Blade Runner, Back to the Future, Terminator 1 and 2, Dune, The Thing, Close Encounters, Planet of the Apes, Children of Men, Mad Max, A Clockwork Orange, Star Trek, 12 Monkeys, District 9, WALL-E, and The Martian.
I'm good with that.
It's a good list, man.
It's a good list. I mean, you could argue about every one. I'm sure people are going to write us in and argue
yes,
about it.
Oh,
gosh. Let us have it.
Don't rush.
We have a top 20 list. It's imperfect, but it's a damn good list.
Yeah.
I think what we need to do is let's sit on it. Let's sit on it for a little while. We'll talk some more about it. We'll get some feedback from the listeners. And, you know, we're going to
So now, Jay, are you going to put Kara into the Clockwork Orange chair with the eyelids open and she's going to watch all 20?
Seriously,
it's
George.
It's the only way, right?
We've made the list. Like, seriously, we've quantified our geekdom. She really needs to start chipping away at this. Like, I want to see this list completely watched in 6 months by her.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a good list.
No excuses.
All righty.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, Squarespace. We haven't talked about them in a while, huh, Jay?
If you want a website and you don't have one, look, it's a hard thing to do. I admit it. This is what I did for 15 years as a career. It's great when you find a piece of software that helps you do something complicated and makes it easy. And that's why I do love Squarespace. And that's why we currently are using Squarespace for one of our websites, because the backend system is so easy that anybody can do it. It's literally a drag and drop system where you just, I want this on my website, and bingo, it's there.
So you're saying it's easy to use, it has all the features and technology that you need to really power your website, and it's trusted also by millions of people and some of the most respected brands and businesses in the world. All for what starts at $8 a month. Plus, you're going to get a free domain if you sign up for a year.
So start your free trial today with no credit card required at squarespace.com. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code SGU to get 10% off your first purchase. All right, guys, let's get back to the show.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. We have a theme this week. The theme is the United States Constitution.
Oh my God.
This is an election year. In the,
so politics or fiction?
The primary. The primaries.
No, no, the ship.
Next year. No, not the ship.
Yeah, the ship.
Not the ship. And George, you come from near Philadelphia, right?
Well, it's about an hour, so yeah, ish.
Yeah, it's your neck of the woods. It's where the Constitution came from.
Nape of the way.
And there's four items, because you know.
There you go.
Okay. Well, you want to try that, fine.
Okay.
You want to play that game?
So here we go.
I'm already. I'm just resigning myself, and I'm going to.
Bob,
four items. Come on, you guys are Americans. Four items. Three are
real Americans. Tell me about your Constitution, please.
Three are true. One of these is fake. You try to figure out which one is the fake. Here we go.
Okay.
Item number one, the word democracy or some version of the word appears in the Constitution 11 times. Item number two, the Constitution does not require the Speaker of the House to be a member of Congress, so theoretically the House could elect anyone as their Speaker. Item number three, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams did not sign the Constitution. And item number four, the Constitution was penned by Jacob Shallus, a Pennsylvania General Assembly clerk who remarkably misspelled Pennsylvania in the document. All right, Evan, go first.
All right. The word democracy, some version of it, appears in the Constitution 11 times. I don't know how really you expect anybody to know that for certain or not, unless you have the Constitution memorized, and I would wager that none of us do.
Really?
So,
you call yourself an American?
Yeah, turn in your card. Turn in your Social Security card. I got to move on. The Constitution does not require the Speaker of the House to be a member of Congress. Theoretically, they could elect anyone as their Speaker. I am inclined to say that that one's going to turn out to be science. I also think that the Speaker of the House typically doesn't vote on matters, although they have the option to, but typically it's sort of tradition that they don't, unless it's kind of important matters. So the Speaker has sort of its own position above the rest of the House of Representatives, and therefore I think that one will probably wind up being science. Third, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams did not sign the Constitution. I'm going to say that this one is also science. These are names, obviously, that you associate with the American Revolution. They're synonymous with the American Revolution. Yet this is kind of, I think, one of those little pivots and little divots in history, I'll say, in which these two fellas didn't do this part of it. The last one, Constitution penned by Jacob Shallus, and he misspelt Pennsylvania in the document. I'm inclined to say that this one's the fiction. The reason for that is that you didn't have a codified means of spelling things, I think, back in those times. The American version of English was sort of, I don't know if it was in this transitional phase or something, but you used to have certain letters were kind of spelt a little bit differently than others. There were these 13 colonies, you know, colonies from the South, maybe spelt things differently in the top than the northern states. But I think what's happened here is that they used actually different characters, but it's technically not a misspelling. So I'm going to say that, therefore, that one's the fiction.
Okay, Jay.
That's interesting you say that, Evan, because I thought that the Constitution had a lot of errors in it, if I remember correctly. There were, you know, not conceptual errors, but it was handwritten. A lot of it was handwritten. So, yeah, there.
Well, it's, you know, I misspell Pennsylvania. I misspell it. I know how to spell Mississippi because Steve tells a joke with that in it, so I can spell that one. I know that some of these people did not sign the Constitution. I don't know who. So I guess it could have been these two guys. I just don't know. I know that there were people that were not all in the United States and not all there. And, you know, it wasn't like we, you know, everyone was there and it was like they were all patting each other on the back. It certainly was not like that. But I don't know. I don't know who was absent, but I know that some people were. The second one about the Speaker of the House does not need to be a member of Congress. I mean, who the hell knows the answer to that? I don't even think you do, Steve, and you wrote this freaking game. Yeah, sure. Okay. I don't know. The first one I find the absolute most provocative. The word democracy does not appear in the Constitution. I know for certain it does not appear in the Constitution 11 times, so I'm going to say that one's the fake.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, I was leaning towards the Pennsylvania misspelling. I mean, come on. He's the Pennsylvania General Assembly Clerk, and he misspelled it. I mean, that just that doesn't sound right to me, especially for such an important document. But the democracy one, that one kind of leaped out at me. Like, yeah, this is one of those trick ones where, like, it's not in there at all. I don't know what the hell they say, but that's all I got to say about this. That's fiction. Democracy's fiction.
George.
I know that the Speaker of the House does not need to be a member of Congress because of the issue that's going on right now with John Boehner resigning. They want to get someone because no one wants to do it. It's such a crappy job right now with the Republicans. No one wants to do it. So I know that is true. I know that Pennsylvania is misspelled in the Constitution because I'm a resident of Pennsylvania, and that is something that they quiz us every Tuesday. I don't know for sure if TS and JA signed, and I don't know for sure if democracy is 11 times. I think that the word democracy is not in the Constitution, maybe even one time, if not 11 times. So I would say that is the fiction.
Okay, so Bob, Jay, and George think that the first one about democracy is the fiction. Evan, you think that – which one did you go with, the Pennsylvania?
I went with the misspelling.
Everyone thinks the Pennsylvania being misspelled. So we'll start with the second one.
Choice.
The Constitution does not require the Speaker of the House to be a member of the Congress, so theoretically the House could elect anyone as their Speaker. George is very confident that this one is science. And this one is science. That is correct, George. This isn't at
Pop
issue
champagne.
Because currently yes. are trying to replace Boehner as Speaker of the House. So, interestingly, the Speaker of the House is the third in line for the office of president.
Yeah.
So it's president,
right.
vice president,
right.
and then the Speaker. So, theoretically, the House could elect someone to be their Speaker. And then they would become the president if both the president and the vice president were killed or something. And so you could have a completely unelected, appointed individual become president of the United States.
That doesn't seem right.
But that's constitutional. Mm-hmm. There are no restrictions on who – just the Constitution just says that the House will elect their speaker. That's it. There's no restrictions on who that is.
So it could be a dog. Yeah. And that's a great Disney film.
Well, they can't – the dog can't take the oath. So
right.
no.
Right.
Pooper of the House. No. Sorry, the film is called House Trained. The film is
House
called
Trained.
House Trained.
Good job.
That's what the film's called.
Oh,
sorry. Okay.
Nice.
Sorry,
all right.
Move on, Steve.
And
sorry.
You all agree that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams did not sign the Constitution, and that one also is science.
Also.
So you guys are doing okay so far. So
yeah. They were abroad.
They were out of the country. Were abroad. Yeah, so you would think. It sounds so counterintuitive at first, like, you know, Thomas Jefferson, you know, right. so influential, and even John Adams, of course. Yeah, Thomas Jefferson was in France and John Adams was in England during the Constitutional Convention, so they were not available to sign the Constitution.
Well, there's a place in France where the naked ladies.
Yeah.
Oh, I got to think back to my third grade history for that
Sorry.
One, George.
Very interesting. Yeah, the Constitutional Convention was actually very controversial in a lot of ways. So first of all,
fascinating.
When they first came together, it was more to just modify the
Articles of Confederation.
And then they realized that they had to just scrap it and start from scratch. But they didn't want anyone to know about it. So they did it behind closed doors in complete secret.
Really?
Yeah.
Gee, that never happened.
Nobody knew what they were doing until they were done.
They didn't post it on Facebook?
Yeah.
Or tweet it.
Not everybody there agreed to sign it. There was several people who were there did not want to sign it. Of the 13 original colonies, do you know the state that held out the longest against ratifying the Constitution?
Delaware?
Nope, Delaware Utah. Was the first. Delaware was the first to ratify it.
First to ratify it.
Rhode Island.
Out the longest.
Rhode Island? No? Rhode Island didn't even send a delegate to the convention. They were completely opposed to the Constitution, and they held out for a couple of years or a few years. They had not ratified it when George Washington became president. And the reason for that was because the party that was in power in Rhode Island at the time was afraid of a strong federal government because they thought they were going to force them to pay their debts in actual money. And therefore, they were just against the Constitution and the strong federal government.
Was this the first con, you think? Did they have like badges and stuff, do you figure? Yeah.
All right. Let's go back to number one. The word democracy or some version of the word appears in the Constitution 11 times. Evan thinks this one is science. The rest of you think this one is fiction.
Well.
And this one is the fiction.
Yeah, baby.
Yay!
And I have to thank Larry Fitzgerald for that. I knew that. I knew it.
Yeah.
It appears.
I couldn't believe it.
There you go.
The word democracy or any version of the word
zero
does
times.
Not okay, appear cool. in the Constitution. Does not appear at all.
Kind of makes sense.
Because the Constitution is a document of a republic. You know, it essentially establishes our government as a republic.
Yeah, I knew it was a republic thing.
Right. The word doesn't even appear in the Constitution. All of this means that the Constitution was penned by Jacob Shallis, a Pennsylvania General Assembly clerk who remarkably misspelled Pennsylvania in the document that is science. Evan, you're sort of right at the time. And in fact, there are several misspellings in the Constitution. There's also several uses of the British spelling rather than what we now know as the American spelling, like honor, H-O-N-O-U-R, instead of O-R.
O-R.
But Pennsylvania is just flat out misspelled. They spelled it with one N.
That was
the most glaring mistake in the document. So yeah, that is considered to be an error, not an acceptable spelling of the time. So very interesting. But good job, guys. Three of you got it. Well
Yay.
Done.
Yeah, I think I got close. So
well, Evan, as a consolation prize, you get to give us the quote of the week.
This week's quote as follows. Supernatural explanations always mean the end of inquiry. That's the way God wants it. End of story. Science, on the other hand, is never satisfied. Our studies of the universe will continue until humans go extinct. From the book Why Evolution is True, written by Jerry Coyne.
Yep. Excellent book. Excellent author. And that's the sentiment in that quote is spot on. That's the biggest problem with religious or supernatural explanations is that they end the debate. It ends all inquiry. That's the God of the gaps. Why fill the gaps when you've already filled it with your magic, you know? But of course, science is about not only filling the gaps, but then digging deeper so that there are more gaps underneath, and it keeps digging down deeper and deeper and deeper.
That's right. We talk about the layers of the onion. You solve one mystery and two more are revealed.
And that's great.
And it continues and it goes on and on. It's the way we advance.
Hey guys, I wanted to do a shout out. One of the SGU listeners has been running a blog of basically collected comments from prominent astronomical thinkers such as Fraser Cain, Pamela Gay, Nicole Gagliucci, Seth Shostak, of course. And for some reason, he wanted to include me in those luminaries. I'm not sure why, but the comments, it's basically question and answer, and it's like recent news in astronomy or other interesting things. Like, hey, what's your favorite solar system vacation destination? Just cool little questions that he throws out there, and it's on astronomyfinest.blogspot.com. That's astronomyfinest.blogspot.com. So check it out and see what everyone has to say. Thanks.
We also have another announcement this week. Nexus 2016, we have the date, May 12th through 15th. May 12th through 15th, 2016, in New York City. This is the 8th annual Nexus Conference. It was a big hit last year. You know, this is just the save the date announcement. We'll give you more information when we start to fill in our speakers list. But of course, the SGU will be there. We're going to be doing the Skeptical Extravaganza again, right, George?
Yeah, baby.
Just so much fun. So much fun. And it was just I think it was a big hit last year. We're going to even make it better this year, right, guys?
better.
Not bigger.
More extravaganza.
More nudity. I think that's where we need to go with it. Yeah. So always a fun, fantastic science and skeptical conference. So check it out. May 12th to 15th. All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
You're a good man, Steve.
You're welcome, Steve.
You are.
George, thanks for joining us. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Yes.
Thank you, George.
Thanks, guys. Always great to be
here.
Great,
George.
Thank you.
You're awesome.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.